From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Provence in the fall and winter of 1970. At the time, it seemed like nothing more than a series of lunches and dinners, chance meetings. It turns out, though, what was happening in Provence in 1970 was larger than that. That's because some of the most iconic culinary figures in the world were in Provence at that time, not because they were planning to cross paths either. It was largely by chance. Julia Child and her husband owned a house in Provence where they often retreated to escape the maelstrom of fame. James Beard was over 300 pounds and had checked himself into a diet clinic in Provence. The American Richard Olney lived there, but he was a bit of a hermit. He was a growing force in the food world at the time. And MFK Fisher, for my money, the greatest food writer ever, was making her way through France with her sister. She was 62 years old. She had long loved France and its food, wrote for The New Yorker, wrote great books, and her trip in that year was perhaps an unexpected awakening for her, kind of a disillusionment. Those figures all converged in the south of France, and what happened next helped set the course for American food for decades. They not only made dinners for one another, but they debated. Should food be higher end or more egalitarian? Is food too snobbish, or should it be snobbish? Should the focus be on hard-to-find ingredients or authenticity and even simplicity? For example, what does an artichoke really taste like? There were tense debates and some ruptured relationships, but those discussions have impacted, in many ways, all of us. Journalist Luke Barr is the grandnephew of MFK Fisher, and when he found her journals from 1970, he knew he had found a story that had never been told publicly. The resulting book is called Provence 1970. And this is the final conversation in our Summer of Food series here on Connections. I read the book at the beginning of this summer, and I could not stop. It made me think not just about food, but about whether we inevitably grow older and have our romantic views disillusioned. My guest for the hour is the author Luke Barr, who's on the line with us. Luke, thanks for joining the program.
Thank you for having me.
Art Rogers is in studio with me. He's the chef and owner of Lento Restaurant in Rochester, and he is the only James Beard-nominated chef in Rochester history. Art, welcome back to the program to you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
I'm going to start with you, Art, because you just handed the book back to me, and I'm glad you did because I sent my book over to Art, and I haven't seen it in a few months because I tore through this thing. I know you've had a chance to read it.
Yeah, I did.
What stood out? I mean, you're somebody who, and for me, yeah, you're not only a James Beard-nominated chef, but you're one of the really thoughtful people in food in this entire region. And I'm curious, what stands out first and foremost among what you heard from these luminaries in the food world in this book?
Well, I'd never read about them on such, I guess, an intimate level before, through the journals. And I definitely think differently about, especially Richard Olney, who comes in the cross in the book as kind of a snob, but
a brilliant one.
Yeah, I admire what I still do. I don't, you know, judge him any differently based on that. And I feel like, you know, how the book sort of concludes with Olney and Childs and Beard all dining and meeting Alice Waters and Chez Panisse, and that seems to be the tidal wave that's started and is still continuing to go over this country. And I think that out of Provence 1970, that's the way the course of food has shifted.
Yeah, we'll come back to Art on numerous occasions for his take. Luke, for you, you know, you're the grandnephew of MFK Fisher. And again, I just want to state this, and I'm not saying it because Luke's on the program here and he was related to MFK. But listeners, if you're the kind of person who loves food but you never heard of her or haven't read her writings, I just implore you to go back and read them. The author, Anne Zimmerman, reintroduced me to MFK Fisher, and I haven't been able to stop reading her. She is truly a gift to food writing. So for you, Luke, when did this whole thing come to you? When did you understand what had happened that year?
You mean how I found the story to begin with?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting. I found it totally by accident, really. I was an editor at Travel and Leisure magazine for many years, and I was the features editor, so I would assign stories, you know, the longer, more writerly pieces. And I would also sometimes assign myself a story, every once in a while to go on assignment and write about some place in the world. Usually it would coincide with my family vacation, so it was a little bit of a sort of a you know, just a fun thing to do. And it's funny, when I was, for many years at TNL, the kind of stories that I would never assign, just because they're such cliches, is there's a couple of different kinds of stories. One of the kinds of stories that I would never, ever want to assign would be the one where you go in the footsteps of a famous writer or a famous traveler, and you sort of go and explore, in the footsteps of MFK Fisher, for example, which is exactly the story that I assigned myself. And then the other kind of story that I also try to avoid is the sort of finding my family roots, going back to Switzerland to discover, where my mother grew up. And that's another kind of story that, as a travel magazine editor, like, it's just, you've read that story so many times. So it was a little bit ironic when I went to my boss and said, hey, I want to do this family roots traveling in the footsteps of MFK Fisher story, because it's exactly the kind of thing that I would never want to assign anyone. But she said, yes, let's do it. And of course, it turned out to be a great trip. And it was on that trip that I went to Aix-en-Provence, and I discovered, just totally by accident, that all these people had been there together, for a few weeks in 1970, and that seemed like it could be a potentially fruitful book idea. So that's sort of the origin of, I went to visit La Pichune, which was the house that Julia and Paul Child built in the 60s, and it was when I was there that I sort of realized, oh yeah, my great aunt was here, my grandmother had been here, and they were all together, and James Beard was, they were all there together back then, and so that's what turned into the book.
The book is so much fun to read, and I don't mean fun in a breezy, light way. I mean, I think the book is thinking very seriously about what happened to food at the time, but it is so much fun to read because, Luke, you write beautifully about food to begin with, and several times this hour I kind of want to dip into some of that. You also give us a chance to actually hear what these people, Julia
right.
Child...
Yeah, okay. You remind me of the second thing that I should explain.
Oh, yeah.
How the hell did I do it? I mean... it's funny. It's easy enough to discover something like that. Like, all these people were there together for a few weeks, but then I sold the book. Great. And then I had to write the book, and there were two fortunate things, and one of them you already alluded to, which was the journal. But when I sold the book and I started working on this project, I did not know that journal existed.
Wow.
So there was two things. One is, I went up to the Schlesinger Library at Harvard, which has a great sort of culinary collection, and they have all of Julia Child's papers and letters, and they've got all of my great aunt's papers and letters, and they've got Simone Beck's papers. So, and I was digging through all that stuff, and of course, the thing about my book is that they were all there together, so they weren't really generally writing letters to each other while they were there on vacation. Although there actually were a few. MF wrote a letter to Julia saying, oh, that was such a great dinner yesterday. And, so there was a little bit of correspondence even while they were in France together. But generally, they didn't, because they were seeing each other all the time. So there would be no reason to write a letter. However, and this is another thing that I didn't know until I did got into those archives, was that my great aunt was having this sort of long-distance love affair with Arnold Gingrich, who'd been the founding editor of Esquire magazine. He's this incredibly debonair sort of New York literary figure from all the way back to the 30s, 40s. Kind of an interesting guy. And they were having they had some kind of relationship where basically it was sort of a romance, but it was a long distance one because she lived in California and he was in New York. But they wrote each other a letter every day. And they were very religious about this. So when I started doing my research, I realized, wow, I've got all of these letters literally every single day that MF was in Provence, or for that entire trip, even when she's on the boat over from New York. She's writing a letter to Arnold Gingrich every day. So the fact that I had this daily account of, what she did and what she was thinking and what was the gossip and... that was incredibly useful, first of all. And then, as you said, later on, I went into my sort of family storage locker. My cousin, MF's younger daughter, has got a bunch of family stuff. And I was digging through boxes and boxes and boxes, and I found her diary from 1970. So that was another... So between those two things, I was able to get access And then in addition, all the letters that they wrote in general, I mean, they were all wonderful letter writers, not just MF, but Julia Child, Paul Child, Richard Olney. They're all incredibly talented writers. And they were, you know, this was an era when people did write letters, unlike today. So I did have access to a lot of sort of firsthand material, and that did inform, that made the book, that's how I was able to write the book, basically.
Yeah, this just another vote for let's bring back letter writing, because for all the emails and texting that we do, we're not preserving very much of this, and this was just a treasure trove for Luc Barre as he put together the book Provence 1970. The letters are beautifully written. They are really a pleasure to read in their own voice. You know, when they're not on television or they're not writing for publication, they're writing to friends, they're talking to each other. MF is writing her thoughts in her journal. And to get that peeled back was so interesting. So if we could, Luc, let's kind of set the stage at the time. I kind of did a little bit off the top here, but let's talk about the people that you wrote about. Let's start with MFK Fisher, who was traveling through France with her sister. What were they doing at the time?
Well, you know, they were just going on vacation. There was no grand scheme, but the truth was that both MF and my grandmother, her sister, they'd traveled a lot in Europe. Also, you know, going back to when MF was a young woman, I mean, she'd been to France, you know, in 1929, early 1930s, to her first marriage, living in Dijon and so forth. So she had a long history and, you know, writing about France for various magazines and writing books about it. And then in the 1950s, she and her sister had, you know, gone on these trips, which I grew up hearing about when I was a kid. You know, all my dad and his brothers and my aunts and other people, like, they had grown up with, they'd gone over, you know, they did this more than once, but they went over on a boat for a year. This is the kind of thing that I guess, was more doable. But the dollar was so strong, you just sort of could pick up and head to Europe for a year, put your kids into the local school in Switzerland or in France, have the kids learn French. So I grew up hearing about those trips, and they had done a couple of them in the 50s and 60s with their kids. So now, though, it's 1970, the kids are all grown up, and they're going on a little bit of a trip of nostalgia. You know, going back to France, going to all the places they loved so much, traveling on a riverboat, going down to visit friends in Provence. Julia Child and Paul Child are going to be there too. Oh, we'll visit them. So that was they were just on vacation basically, but yes. And this gets to one of the deeper themes of the book, which has to do with the sort of American relationship to France, particularly in terms of food and cooking. There was a long time when good food in this country was French food. It just went without saying that, you know, the great restaurant, was a French restaurant. You know, Julia Child herself was American, obviously, but her TV show was called The French Chef because she was teaching how to cook French food. That was considered the sort of state-of-the-art, that was good cooking. So all these questions are a little bit in the air, though, in 1970. You know, what exactly is good cooking? Does it have to be French? Maybe there's such a thing as, you know, great American cooking. In fact, Beard is off. You mentioned that he's at the diet clinic, which is all sort of a comic relief because, of course, he doesn't lose any weight at the diet clinic, hanging out with all these
people. Well, don't go to Provence, France for a diet clinic. Let's just put it that way.
I know. Yeah, that's a little bit preposterous. But anyway, you know, he was there. He was writing his book, you know, which was meant, his book, you know, which was meant to be an American version of the Mastering the Art of French Cooking, which was Julia and Simca's book. He had done all this research about, you know, all the different regional kinds of cooking in America, Southern cooking, Southern fried chicken, you know, on the West Coast, and so he gathered huge amounts of information about, you know, regional American cooking, and was putting it together in this sort of magnum opus of his. So there's a lot of this kind of, you know, rethinking of what it means, what is good food? And that ended up, when I was doing my research, ended up being the sort of theme of the of the book, really, because they're all dealing with this problem in different ways.
And then the one character who is a very important part of the book, and Art Rogers mentioned him, but is maybe a little less familiar to listeners, would be Richard Olney. And the Boston Globe quoted right out of the bat on Chapter 4, and I was going to do that. So I'm just going to read right out of Chapter 4,
okay.
An epic dinner with Richard Olney, because the Globe, as the Globe says, Barr's description continues in this vein throughout the book, covering many courses and pages, edifying not in just the way it tantalizes our senses, but in the way Luke Barr is able to sketch each character through his or her cooking style. That's from the Boston Globe. I couldn't agree more, and I'll just read a little bit from the opening of that chapter. Quote, Richard Olney was preparing a feast. He sat at the kitchen table with a small pointy knife, painstakingly piercing each large piece of beef stew meat and inserting a small strip of pork fat into the incisions. The strips of pork belly had been covered with a paste of chopped parsley and garlic and would add flavor to the meat from the inside out. He put the larded meat in a bowl, poured a bit of olive oil and cognac, and then a bottle of dry white wine over it, and left it all to marinate. It was late November and raining outside. He was alone in the kitchen. He was happiest at moments like this. And then you go on to talk about the sea urchins that he had picked up from the fishmonger in Toulon. The sea urchins were still alive, their black spines moving. He filleted the fish and started a stock with the bones, pouring over water and wine. It would cook for hours, and until it had thickened to a jelly-like substance, he would use to coat the tureen the next day. So he used a scissor to open up dozens of sea urchins, holding the sharp, spiny shells in a folded dish towel to avoid injury to himself, and spooning out the pungent and slightly spongy roe inside. They smelled of the ocean. He combined the vivid orange roe with a small amount of uncooked chopped white fish, then pushed the mixture through a fine sieve, one tablespoon at a time. They were the first ingredients in what would become a mousseline, a very delicate foam-like mousse that would be surrounded by the sole fillets. I'm already in. I want to know more about Richard Olney's cooking, but let me just ask you, who is this guy for people who didn't know who Richard Olney was, Luke?
Richard Olney, I know. I hadn't heard of him either, although it's funny. I did, once I started working on the book, I realized, oh, I have some Richard Olney cookbooks on my bookshelf that my grandmother had given me at some point or whatever. So, like, he was around. I just hadn't noticed. He was younger than the others. You know, the others are, MF was 62, like you said. Julia, similar, you know, same age, basically. They're in their late 50s, early 60s. Whereas Olney is, you know, maybe 47, something like that. He's a different generation, and he's not nearly as well known. So from his point of view, he sees Beard and Julia especially as the, you know, they're the sort of reigning, you know, they're famous, they're established, they run the food world in a sort of, from his point of view, a sort of smug, self-satisfied perch, you know, and he's sort of trying to break into that world. He's also, you know, a very resentful, you know, psychologically he's fun to write about because he just says such cruel things about people all the time. He could just be supremely cruel and bitchy about everyone. And when you're writing a book like this, you know, it's kind of great to have a character like that. I don't think, you know, I often think to myself, God, thank God I had Olney because I needed a little bit of that villainous character in the mix. But then I also think that, you know, in some ways he ends up being the hero of the story, you know, because he is leading the way in some ways toward the future, toward Chez Panisse, toward a kind of, you know, at least one of the strands of cooking that comes out of this moment is that kind of, you know, he's growing the farm to table, growing your own vegetables, making only what's seasonal. You know, his cookbook, for example, I don't know that it's the very first. Someone has corrected me and said that Waverly Root wrote a book earlier than the 60s about seasonal menus. But certainly, he really, you know, his cookbook, which was just published that fall of 1970, was organized around seasons. So here's winter menus. Here's a casual winter lunch. Here's a fancy winter feast, you know, all like that. So and he produces these elaborate menus. So he's always thinking seasonally. He's also, you know, he's interested in elevating, you know, what he calls bourgeois cooking, just like the kind of, just the simple beef stew that any French woman in a village somewhere might make. You know, he elevates that to an art form, and he tries to make the very perfect example of the pot-au-feu or whatever he's making. So that's him. You know, he grew up in the Midwest. He came to New York City. This would have been in the late 50s, early 60s, I guess, and sort of wanted to be a painter, and lived in Greenwich Village, and then he moved to Paris, and he was a painter, and he kind of taught. He's a self-taught cook. He did not, you know, apprentice anywhere, or, you know, he was untrained in that way. He was a sort of, he taught himself how to cook, and he started writing for food magazines in France. And then in the mid-60s, he went down to outside of Toulon, and he found this ramshackle house, and he sort of started renovating it pretty much by himself. He dug the wine cellar by himself, and sort of created this incredible kitchen and lifestyle for himself there. And one other thing, I think maybe you mentioned this too, mentioning his wine cellar just reminds me, he was very knowledgeable about wine. And being very, very knowledgeable about wine is, he's also just a terrific snob. You know, it's the kind of that vein of thinking and tasting and being knowledgeable is just prone to snobbery. And so that's another element of the story that I kept on bumping up against was, what is the meaning of taste, and does it inevitably mean that you're a snob if you have good taste or not? And so, since I have some of these characters tend to be very, astute and educated and love to talk about wine, whereas others are becoming a little more impatient with that sort of approach to cooking and food and taste.
Yeah, I got that MFK Fisher and some of the others found Richard Olney maybe brilliant but exhausting.
Yeah.
That it was
and very judgmental. It's funny, and when I was, he had a reputation of just being very prickly and difficult. And as I said, he was very ungenerous when it came to his assessment of Julia Child and MFK Fisher and James Beard and all these people that, were, older than him and more established, and he just thought they were, frauds and terrible cooks and, so... Like I said, having someone with that sort of cantankerous attitude when you're writing a book like this is helpful, particularly when, the truth is not a whole lot happened in the fall and winter of 1970. Here I am writing this book about these incredible characters. I mean, they're all so different and they're all so colorful and interesting to write about. But then, you kind of want there to be a dead body and a murder mystery or something to happen. And when I was writing, I realized, there isn't really that. What happens is something that's more subtle. It has to do with, as I already said, the shift in and this argument about taste and what it meant. And the fireworks, such as they were, they all stem from that sort of set of disagreements or, trying to think through that problem.
Sure, and I think without Richard Olney, you wouldn't have had some of the conflict that did push at least these people to think more deeply about their values when it came to food and where food was going and what Americans wanted to do with it and how to make it more egalitarian or should it be more snobbish. I just thought Richard Olney was such a compelling person, and I will tell you, Luke, I get together with friends every winter around the new year. I am going to be making adobe a la Provençal. And my wife already found a Richard Olney recipe for that. So I'm going to do my best. I thought the food writing was so much fun in this book, but I think it was the most detailed around Richard's because he was the most meticulous. And Art Rogers, who is the chef and owner of Lento Restaurant in Rochester, Art, we've talked about in your own restaurant, you understand that there are certain things that you have to do, but you want to make sure people find certain things accessible. But if it were up to you, you might do... sweetbreads and things like that. You might do things that are a little bit what the general public might consider more exotic. I'm curious to know how much you enjoyed reading about Richard Olney, who I talked about urchins, but his stuff wasn't even necessarily exotic. It was just so detailed and painstaking, and I wondered if you thought, I would love to be able to do this every day. What did you think?
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. I loved reading that, and I was like, it would be great to be able to cook and... Geez, not just a restaurant kitchen, but even to be able to cook like that at home. But Richard Olney lived by himself. He didn't have three little kids running around. he had all day and, tons of days to prepare all these things and have them set up for, you know, just that extravagant lunch he made when MKF Fisher came up for the first time. And it's definitely different.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but what else is about Richard that's so funny is he's very dismissive of what he calls hotel cooking, which doesn't, I mean, it's sort of an anachronism. It's like something from the late 60s, early 70s. But this idea that you go to a fancy restaurant and then you sit down and then the waiters come over very theatrically and they bring you like something that then they light it on fire and then it's flaming there. And that all that stuff all that kind of fancy presentation and the way that we think of French food and a fancy French restaurant circa mid-1960s, right? He's just so dismissive of that. And I think that's kind of, you know, a crucial breakthrough when you think about it, like that food doesn't have to be so... There is something kind of fraudulent about there can be something that seems fraudulent about that kind of cooking, as opposed to Richard, who's in it, like, you know, there he is with his, you know, scotch, and he's drinking for, you know, hours while he's putting the lard into the meat, and, you know, that kind of elevated, you know, to an extreme, that kind of elevated home cooking is something that's great. And that sort of leads to another topic, which I'd like to hear your thoughts on too, Art, which is, you know, the whole idea of home cooking versus restaurant cooking. I mean, that's another thing that sort of feels like it's shifted a lot in between, you know, then and now, which is this veneration of, or the veneration of restaurant, of the sort of theatrical restaurant experience, which nowadays, you know, we turn on the TV and there's chefs and there's celebrity chefs and there's competitions and all this kind of stuff around food, whereas back then the food world seemed much smaller. And there was more focus on cooking at home and the home, you know, the writing cookbooks for the home cook. So that's another thing that sort of feels like, you know, has changed a little bit.
Yeah, what do you think, Art?
You're definitely right about that. With cookbooks in general, my wife and I will look at cookbooks and she'd be like, no, this is a cookbook for you. There's stuff in there that's just, she looks at it, it's over her head immediately. And I think there are a lot of cookbooks out there that are written for people to just sort of peruse or for chefs, because the stuff is complex and not really approachable to home cooks.
But, you know, Art, in reading this book, and I think it came from this book, again, it's been a few months since I tore through this book in about a couple of days. I think Julia Child did a bread recipe that had like 54 steps. And some people, you know, so Richard Olney maybe, you know, held up as this devotee of every little step and getting it perfectly right. But Julia Child was not afraid to assume that American cooks, American, often was the American housewife, but certainly not always, could handle this stuff if you can lay it out
totally.
step by step. Right?
I think they really could.
Go ahead, Luke, and then we'll go to Art. Go ahead, Luke.
Oh, I was just going to say that, she was cooking for a specific reader in mind. You know, her reader was probably a woman, but not necessarily a woman, but someone who was going to shop at an American supermarket and was going to try to make, a French baguette. Well, it turns out that's pretty hard because the flour is different. You know, and so she was extremely, almost pathologically, you know, focused on, you know, Simone Beck, her partner, who was French and was sort of severe and, you know, talking about how to do things in the correct French way. Julia was the one who's translating it for the American reader and saying, well, it has to be doable. It has to be possible to do it. But yes, absolutely, in a very detailed way. Whereas I feel like today, you know, you go to a bookstore and there are many wonderful cookbooks, I must say. I mean, it's just fantastic how great food is and the food culture we have in this country. We shouldn't take it for granted. You know, food used to be much worse in this country. It's one thing I've realized doing this book. But anyway, there is such a thing nowadays of the kind of cookbook that gets published, and it's really just meant to be on your coffee table.
Yeah. And it, not the kind of thing that people are going to use on a weeknight.
Right.
And so, but Art, I guess, do you think that has changed then since when Julia Child was putting out a 54-step bread recipe? Is that a bad thing, Art? Or is that...
No, how do you view that? I think the difference between then and now is the person that book was written for had time. You know, I don't see most families having that luxury to be able to follow that French baguette recipe.
I think that's fair.
You know, maybe on a Sunday and everyone pitches in and you do the Sunday dinner, but everyone's so busy now. And
we don't need to. I mean, you can find good bread now. You don't have to make it yourself.
That's true. Now there is good bread.
Back in 1970, I mean, I can remember when I was a kid in the 1970s in California, there was no good bread. Bread was like, there was San Francisco sourdough French bread. That was good bread. And then everything else was like squishy Wonder Bread kind of bread. And my mom was Swiss, and so like she was making her own bread. Of course, that was the sort of 70s thing to do, right? But I think don't take it for granted that like now, yeah, I can walk out. I live in Brooklyn. Like I've got multiple options for freshly baked baguettes, you know, within walking distance. I don't think that was the case. I mean, I know that was not the case, you know, even when we were kids, you know what I mean? So there might have been like more of a reason to want to figure out how to bake bread that maybe now we don't quite need as much.
I've got to get our only break of the hour, and I'm way late for a break, and this hour is flying by. But if you're just joining us, we're talking about the book Provence 1970, M.F.K. Fisher, Julia Child, James Beard, and the Reinvention of American Taste. Luke Barr, the author, is on the line with us, and this is a book that I flagged right at the beginning of the summer when I said, if we're going to do a Summer of Food series of conversations about trends and in the food and drink industry, agriculture, etc., this was a must, because if you love food, if you care about food, if you care about where food comes from, this book takes you back to 1970, and I'm going to disagree with what Luke said. Luke said not a whole lot happened. Well, I think what he's saying is there wasn't this dramatic moment of a murder on a hillside, but there was plenty that happened in this book, and this book, I think, takes us inside the kinds of conversations and dinners that just happened with some of these luminaries in the food world who just happened to be in the south of France in the fall and winter of 1970. And because of the journals and the letters they wrote and the work that Luke Barr did as a journalist to kind of bring those all to the surface, we get this narrative now to put it all together. And after our short break, we're going to kind of delve through what it all means now. I'll share my thoughts on who I think sort of won these battles these groups were having about the future of food. And we'll see what Art thinks as well and continue with Luke and Art Rogers, the chef and co-owner of Lento Restaurant in Rochester. And I'll tell you that Friday on Connections, it's Unleash the Pet Show. What happens when you decide to bring a feral cat into your home? I did. Two of them, in fact. And we're going to talk about how to socialize animals for family life. And we'll also learn about Lollipop Farm's equine program. And our guest veterinarian is going to take your calls about pet health and behavior tomorrow. Then in our second hour, Second Opinion Live this month, we're talking about drug allergies and how they impact your health and the care you receive. That's all tomorrow. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and Luke Barr, author, on the line with us. Art Rogers in studio with me. Art, the only James Beard-nominated chef in Rochester history, had a chance to read the book as well. And the book is Provence 1970. Great fun, great, you know, just great narrative to read, especially if you love food. And it's our final conversation in the Summer of Food series of conversations. And if you want to check out some of the others, we've had a chance to talk about everything from new restaurants, philosophies of food, the growing cider industry, and even why Americans are eating less cereal. It's all on our website, wxxinews.org/connections, and just look up Summer of Food. So we've kind of sketched out this character, Richard Olney, and we've talked about M.F.K. Fisher. I wanted to ask Luke Barr about something about M.F.K. Fisher that made me a little sad in this book, Luke. And that's this. M.F.K. Fisher is writing about food. The reason I think she's the best food writer ever is she was sensual. She understood that food was pleasure. And that for those who kind of pilloried her as being too sexual about it, I thought that was obviously unfair. She was sensual. And she understood, I think, that we don't all have to be great chefs. She could handle herself in the kitchen, but we can appreciate the sensuality of food, of pleasure, of taste. And she wrote about it so beautifully. it was sparked in many ways by her travels in her, I think, her late 20s and 30s across France. And then so she writes, she starts writing not only books, but she writes for The New Yorker about her experience and travel. And on this particular trip in 1970, it was a little bit of disillusionment. You know, she's traveling through France, and you share her thoughts about how her feelings were changing. And probably appropriately so, given the context of the time. But it did have me thinking. Does this happen to all of us? Will we inevitably get to our 60s and 70s and look back at who we were in our 20s, especially our 30s and maybe our 40s, and think what romantic idiots we were? You know, can we guard against that coarsening of our romanticism if we know it's coming? It's sort of a strange existential question, but I'm curious to know what you think.
That's a really interesting interesting observation and fascinating to think about. Let's see. I have a couple things that your remark sort of makes me want to, or makes me think. One was to the question of sensuality. You know, I think I say this in the book, but it's hard to overstate just how radical that was when she was doing it. I mean, nowadays it doesn't seem remarkable at all. There's a million people writing in many, many different formats, and they can. But for a woman early 1930s, to be writing in a sensual way, and in a kind of confessional way too. You know, she was very personal in the writing. Just to take one example, I mean, she's married. She was married to this guy named Al Fisher. She was very young. He was in his 30s. I think she was, you know, barely, 20, 21, something like that. Very young. And then she kind of fell in love with Dylan Parrish. Someone else. So she's married to one guy. She's falling in love with another guy. Okay, you know, she's probably 25. She's very young when this is happening. And she wrote about it. And she published that. I mean, she published a book, I think it's some sex and some of the scenes in Gastronomical Me. She's still married to Al Fisher, even as she's publishing this book where everyone knows, or she's basically talking about falling in love with someone else. That was pretty radical stuff to be doing in the 1930s. So that's one thing. And the other thing I think is, in terms of her writing style, and this is what struck me. I mean, I grew up, okay, she's my great aunt. I knew her as a kid. You know, we went to lunches at her house and so forth when in the 1970s. The writing, you know, it has a kind of, a lot of her writing has a kind of, yeah, it's very evocative. It's very sort of sensual. To my ear, it can feel slightly overwritten somehow, you know, in that sort of way that New Yorker writers wrote in the 1950s and 60s. Like, if you go back and read that magazine, it will feel a little bit dated in that way, and it's that same way that some of her writing feels. However, if you go back and look at her and read her letters, which is what I did mostly for this book, the letters are, I mean, Evan, I really, if you like her writing in the books, I really urge you to get her book of letters. That's what I guess what I'm saying, because mm-hmm. the letters are so smart and funny, and they're full of gossip, full of humor, you know, and incredibly smart. Just, you know, great observations. And so I one of the things I felt like I wanted to do a little bit in this book is kind of resuscitate M.F.K. Fisher from that, you know, that kind of, yes, it's beautiful and seductive, but it's that kind of highly polished kind of, I'm not quite sure I have the right adjective at my fingertips, that kind of writing. And I wanted to infuse this book with a little more of, you know, so you could get a sense of her as a kind of, you know, as a strong woman who, you know, is writing these kind of chatty, funny letters. And I think I got that voice into the book. Sorry, I'm going on way too long.
No. I can listen to talk about M.F.K. Fisher all day.
Whether it's inevitable that when we, you know, the other thing to remember now, just in terms of life cycles and so forth, is that yet she's 62. She had kids pretty late. She, you know, her kids were basically just kind of had become grown-ups and kind of moved out of the house and started, you know, going to college, and one of them was married and had a little baby. And so, like, in a way, it's kind of, it has to do with age. It has to do with what do you do when, how does it feel when your kids grow up and move out of the house and start having their own families? And then, you know, she was a single mom all those many years. And now she's kind of alone a little bit in the world, and she's kind of untethered a little bit. I think that's the moment that I'm capturing there. I don't know if it's inevitable that we all have that untethered moment when our kids kind of grow up, if we have kids, or when we reach that point when you sort of take stock and you think, wait, did it all turn out the way I wanted? I mean, I suppose maybe that's inevitable. But like I said, I think, you know, for her, it was grappling with, what does it mean to be getting older? I mean, she ended up writing a book called Sister Age, published many years later, but she was kind of working on it for many, many years. She was definitely sort of had an ongoing interest in that question, and I think that is a universal one.
Well, I will say maybe that wasn't on your own radar as a writer for what you wanted readers to be thinking about, but it really impacted me in that way. It had me thinking, you know, at my age now, what can I do to try to be as clear-eyed as I can? And, you know, the wisdom of the years, I don't get to have that until I'm older. So, you know, mm-hmm. but let me ask Art Rogers. I mean, you're on your 10th year with Lento, right? You opened in 2007, right? So this is...
Nine, yeah, in between 9 and 10.
All right, 9 and 10. You know, do you even look back 10 years ago, and do you feel, you know, how do you feel about your own ideas about food, about what you want to do with your restaurant? Have they evolved in 10 years, or do you still feel relatively the same with your ideals, your values, your mission there?
Ideals, values, mission, yeah, that's all still the same.
Okay.
But as far as running a business and things that I've had to do to make it successful, probably complete 180 from the ideal I had when I opened the doors in 2007.
Do you feel, you know, in any way, I don't know if less romantic is the word about it, but do you feel more coarsened by the reality of running a business of it?
Yeah, yep, absolutely, yep.
Do you want to elaborate at all?
Well, I mean, you open a business and you have these great ideas and you're like, everyone's going to love this and they're going to come and they're going to enjoy themselves and it's going to be a great success. And then they come in and most of them do, but then, you know.
They say, how come you don't have a burger on the menu?
Right. Or how come you don't have more vegan options? Or how come you don't have gluten-free options? And how come you don't have this? How come you don't have that? And... And you can't try to please everybody. Some famous restaurateur said that, you know, but to some extent you have to make it accessible to the majority of the people, and if that means putting on a burger or, you know, adding some dishes or doing some things a little differently, then so be it.
So maybe the next time they get the sweetbread. Maybe the next time they get...
Right. Had I opened like a 25-seater,
I think you said head cheese was the one that you would love to do more often.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, so, and I don't mean to make it seem like that in this book, you find out that at 62 years old, MFK Fisher looked back in her career and was like, it's all bunk. That's not the case. I just think...
Let me go a little bit more into detail about the, you know, what happens in this book is MF and my grandmother are on vacation together, right? You know, they leave in September, and they go through France, they go to Paris, they take a boat trip, they end up down in Provence. And at some point in all of this, my grandmother goes back to California. She worked in the Berkeley public school system in California. So she goes back to California. My MF is there alone for a little while. She's visiting these other old friends of hers, Eda Lord and Sybil Bedford, who are they're sort of minor characters in the whole thing, but they're sort of an amusing couple. And they're having all these dinners, and they're visiting James Beard and Julia Child, and all. And there's a lot of socializing, and there's a lot of talk, and it's all in the book, right? But at some point, MF says, "You know what? I just got to get out of here." She needed to be alone. She needed to go away by herself, and she needed to write. And so she left before Christmas, and she went, to Arles and to Avignon, sort of on her own. So she's, you know, a 62-year-old woman traveling alone in the winter, very, very cold winter, that winter, checking into these hotels where she's the only person there practically. And she's a writer, and there's something about her personality. There is a dark, sort of a depressive side to her personality as a writer and her need to write. And what she was writing when she was sitting in that hotel room for days and days and weeks, a few weeks, that was the diary that I found. That was the diary you know, that I found in that storage locker. And it was almost stream of consciousness, and it was quite, it wasn't sad, but it was very unsentimental. I mean, the other thing about her and about that generation of I want to say women, because there, a lot of them in my book are women, but, you know, she and Julia Child were both terrifically sort of unsentimental, tough women at some level, and even with herself. So in this diary, she's writing, you know, she's describing going out alone in the town, looking for some place to have dinner, finding some restaurant that's open, which is really hard to do. She's eating by herself, and she's looking around at the other diners in the room, and she's just, everyone looks a little bit ugly, and the food is shabby and shoddy, and the, you know what I mean? The wine has cork floating in it, and the whole, so she wrote about that in this diary, and of course, that goes against what you might think of, oh, MFK Fisher, you know, writing this, these romantic descriptions of her meals, and, oh, you know, she famously wrote about how she liked to eat alone. People are always quoting that. But here she is eating alone and writing about it in this completely wide open, you know, eyes open way, unsentimentally describing how, what this meal was like. And I, yeah, so there is that sense of, you know, and I in the book I try to tie it back to how is food changing? Even in France, it's changing. What does it mean to have a good meal? All these questions. And there definitely is a little bit of a sense of, you know, she had made so much of France and she had sentimentalized it and romanticized it in her writing for the last, you know, 50 years practically, right? And now she's realizing, well, you know, she's telling it like it is, at least in this instance where she's eating in this restaurant, for example. And she's also realizing, you know, I always thought that I was going to end up retiring on a hillside, you know, with olive trees and beautiful Provence, and that I was going to live out my days here, but actually I'm not. I'm going back to California to be nearer to my children. And, you know, and in some, at some level, that's that compromise between your youthful ideal of, like, how my life is going to be and maybe even how it's going to end, and then the reality when you're 60 and you've got a couple of kids and all the complications. Well, you know, and there is a little bit of a kind of sadness that you can feel there in that diary, and that I tried to get into this book.
No question about it. Well, I'm going to cop out a little. I'm going to offer my assessment on who sort of won, or at least what the impact is, and then we'll have Art Rogers, who will probably do less copping out than I am. Because throughout this book, you have these luminaries in the food world, and they are thinking about food as, you know, in American terms, who makes it? How is it made? You know, as Luke said, is France the epicenter of real and great food, or is James Beard right? In James Beard's book on American cookery, you know, he set aside part for Sloppy Joes. You can't get much more egalitarian than Sloppy Joes. I don't think Richard Olney was making a Sloppy Joes. So they had some of these disagreements. Richard Olney was championing not exclusivity, but painstaking attention to detail and authenticity. As we said, you know, what does a bell pepper actually taste like out of your backyard? What does a tomato taste like? What does an artichoke really taste like? And why are we so used to canned and processed food? Can we bring it back here? And I think Olney was victorious in that, you know, the Chez Panisse of the world and frankly the Lento of the world reflects a lot of that. You know, art is more than most chefs I've ever met devoted to that, at least some of that ethos. Whereas, you know, Julia Child kind of won in that more of us at least feel like we can cook at home if we want to, and there is pretty good bread elsewhere. You know, Olney's going, why is there a bread recipe for you? And Julia Child is saying, Richard, in our country, there's not good bread. Well, there is now. So I think they all sort of won in their own ways, but I'm curious to know, Art, how you feel the impact is. When you go back to 1970, you read this book, and now you think about, you know, the dining scene here, 2016, your work in the restaurant industry. I don't know if anybody won, but what do you make of it?
Well, yeah, I agree with you. I think both sides, for lack of a better term, won, with only focusing on fresh, local, seasonal ingredients, and Julia Child just focusing on being able to cook. I mean, even today, so many people don't cook. And I think that was revolutionary, teaching people to cook well, especially out of the 50s and 60s, which I think is when processed food really sort of hit its stride. And she recaptured something that was lost, or maybe was never here in America, being the melting pot of a country that we are and lacking a food culture. She sort of helped create that, and I agree that James Beard also did the same thing with his American cookery. I mean, America really, like I said, it's a melting pot with a few small exceptions. There is no real American, like, we're going out for American tonight, you know.
It's, what does that mean?
Does exactly, it doesn't exist.
It's more regional because we're a huge country.
But I think it's, you know, starting to, pockets of things are starting to come out of that just now.
Yeah. Luke, about a minute left here. I finished your book saying, as much as Olney gave you a bit of a villain, thank goodness he was there, because I do think his ripples are still being felt. How would you assess the group there and sort of who won?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I don't think of it as winning, but I do think that Olney, partly it's because he was earlier on in his career, so you know he had an impact that way more. But yeah, absolutely. I think Olney shows us the way. We didn't mention Alice Waters exactly. You know, she had Olney's Simple French Food Cookbook, you know, in her kitchen at Chez Panisse. He really was an inspiration for that kind of cooking that was coming out of California at that moment, and which had a huge impact on how we eat today. And then, of course, you know, yeah, Julia is sort of popularizing cooking. Really is a, you know, and also, you know, after this, she sort of moves away from purely French food, and she says, oh, yeah, I'm going to cook some Indian chowders, and I'm going to go on TV and talk about, clam chowders or Indian curries, or like different kinds of international food is happening. People are starting at this moment to think about, like, what about Chinese food? I could cook that, you know. So there's a huge explosion of interest in food that happens from that moment.
Well, I just want to say, first of all, Amy in Rochester called in, couldn't get your call, but she wanted to thank Art for his work, not only at the restaurant, but in the community, educating kids and family about food. Very nice. Art Rogers from Lento, whoever the influence is, Olney, Child, MFK, Fisher, and others, thanks for the work you do, and thanks for being here in studio with us
today. Thanks for having me again. Great.
And Luke, couldn't have enjoyed it more. Great book, Provence 1970, and thanks for being generous with your time for this program today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Luke Barr, Provence 1970. A lot of fun. And I hope you've enjoyed the Summer of Food series of conversations here on Connections. Thanks to Rob and Megan. I'm Evan. Talk to you Friday.